So we'll get started here on the 16th of June, 2021. Isaiah class 11, looking at Isaiah 9 tonight. And it was crazy hot today. It was 109 at the office.
Oh,
109. That is not right. This is Colorado. It's not supposed to be 109. It's supposed to be 109 in Texas. Well, I don't even know what the temperature would be in Arizona today, because yesterday it was 113. I don't know why anybody would live in like Arizona or Nevada. Crazy hot, but it was way too hot today. So I put on a timer to the swamp cooler and tried to figure out a way to make things cooler. And it's just gonna, we'll see. But anyway, it's cooling off now, thank goodness. And we can continue our study. The way it ended last time, and we've been in this pattern for a little while now, where Isaiah is going to tell them the good news and the bad news, basically. Typically the bad news, the more bad news, and then a little bit of good news. But the little bit of good news is the ultimate good news, so it all kind of balances out. Anything on the left side of the scales plus Jesus on the right is, you know, Jesus wins. So, and we've been talking about how these problems are going to be fixed. But last week we had him have a baby, Meir Shalah Hashbaz, and we had his child be, you know, bringing a message from God, basically, which was that Israel is sort of rushing into disaster. But there was another mention of Emmanuel coming, and they got their instructions again about what they need to do. But it says, once again, you're not going to do it. It's going to really be bad. You guys, I can't believe you guys. And then it talked about the main lesson of chapter 8, which was what we're supposed to do. If you're living in a broken world, if you're living in a broken culture or society, if you're living in a place that has fallen away or is, you know, doing things against God, what do you do? And we got our instructions in chapter 8, which was to bind up the testimony and to seal up the law and to basically stay together in some kind of little remnant, which is pretty much exactly what this class is. So that's pretty much what we're doing. So far, so good. And it ended with some kind of rough stuff at the end of chapter 8. And the reason I'm recovering that is because it goes into that continuation in chapter 9. But the way it ended, the last couple of verses of 8 was, they will pass through it hard-pressed and hungry. And it shall happen when they are hungry that they will be enraged and curse their king and their God and look upward. Then they will look to the earth and see trouble and darkness, gloom and anguish, and they will be driven into darkness. And that's not good. You know, we don't have all the exact details of what that vision means. If it's close by, in other words, it's coming up right away to Isaiah's people at that time with the Assyrians, or if we're talking about the future, or we're talking about the end of time. As we've discovered, Isaiah likes to hit it all over the place. And we talked about the way that was phrased, how they were having trouble, and they looked up at God, and then they were enraged, and they cursed in God, and then looked down to the earth, which made it worse. And it was basically a series of events. Like, you are a believer, and then you're sliding away, and then you're cursing God, still believing, but cursing God, and now you're just looking completely away from God, just at earthly things, and then you're just completely in darkness. So that was the pathway. Now, the reason I really wanted to remind you of that is because as we come into 9 is going to be another very big, very serious sort of hint about the future in a good way, including, you know, how this problem is going to be solved. So it says, and this is the New King James, and it says, nevertheless, so all that's going on that was just there in chapter 8, right? All that stuff's going on. Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed, as when at first he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterwards more heavily oppressed her. So this is all very complicated, right? By the way of the sea beyond the Jordan in Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who walked in darkness have seen great light. Those who dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. Now, this is as deep and serious as poetry gets, not only in the Bible, but period, in the world. And it's extremely difficult for us to figure out exactly what's going on, because there's a lot of imagery, and we also are not really fully nailing what I would call the time frame. Is this something happening right now? Is this something happening in the far future? And yeah, that's the answer is yes. And so that's the problem. So, for instance, let me pull up a thing if I have that. I tried to save my my analysis thing. Let's see if it's if I missed it or not. Anyway, we're going to walk through this and realize it's actually a good thing, because a light is going to be shining in the darkness. And I've got way too much stuff on my phone to actually see what is actually going on. There it is. Okay. Have you ever looked at your screen and had so many icons, you just have no idea what's actually going on? That's my life right there. So we're going to go to this analysis here, and then we've got to go to section. Come on, guys. Change pages for me. All right. So well, what just happened? Now I lost it. All right, so now I'm going to get everything up at the same time. So let's look at it again. So nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her as who is distressed, as when at first he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. See, that's crazy, right? Afterwards, more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan in Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. Do you see how odd that is when it comes to the way that's phrased? Here's how it reads. First of all, we get a hint, right? And the hint is Galilee. So everybody knows the Galilee is the region of the north where Jesus is from, right? So the lake or the Sea of Galilee, and we know about the Sea of Galilee because the Sea of Galilee is where the fishermen did their thing with the boat, where Peter walked on water, all that stuff happened. All the water stuff from Jesus was happening on Galilee. His ministry was all around the Sea of Galilee. All those stories that we have are all these places, the feeding of the 5,000 and the guy that had the demons that was in the, you know, in the tombs, and all the stuff and all the cities and all that stuff is Galilee. And in that area, the people walked in darkness. They've seen a great light. Look how he writes it. Those people in Galilee have seen a great light. They dwelt in the land of the shadow of death. Upon them, light has shined. So a light came into the world. So what this is Jesus, in the past tense, 700 and some years before Jesus. So this is the way you can understand exactly how crazy Isaiah is. Because he is talking about Jesus in the past tense, 8 centuries before Jesus. So that is absolutely, how are you supposed to, as a regular human being with regular English reading capabilities, supposed to get your head around that? And it is. It's extremely difficult to figure out what's happening. But it's not Isaiah's fault. Isaiah is delivering the word of God, right? So Isaiah is saying, hey, guys, this is what I'm seeing. And what he's seeing is, of course, this light in the darkness. This is very similar to probably something that John the Baptist would have seen as a vision, but he would have seen it right before Jesus would have arrived. You know, here comes the light of the world, basically, is how John the Baptist was dealing with, you know. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the north, okay? We're talking about the kingdom of Israel as opposed to the kingdom of Judah. Now, I know this is confusing because the kingdom of Israel is everything. Israelites are everything. So all the 12 tribes, which are the children of Israel, which is a guy named Jacob, and his name was turned to Israel. I know it's all confusing. But when it divides into two kingdoms. The north is Israel, the south is Judah, Jerusalem's in Judah. Galilee is in the north. Galilee is in this area that we've been talking about for the last few chapters, which has sided with the enemy and is going to attempt to attack. So in other words, the darkness that has overcome this place, it's connected to Samaria, it's connected to the northern tribe or the northern kingdom and the bad kings, is connected to them turning against their brothers in the south. And this is long before Jesus comes along, and it's still bad, right? It's always bad. But so this northern area is about to be attacked by the Assyrians, and this is going to bring great gloom. So we have a current problem that this is describing. We have a future problem it's describing. We have a very far future problem, and then we have the end of the world problem. And it applies to all of that. There will be great darkness upon this land in the very near future when the Assyrians attack. There'll be great darkness upon this land throughout the future. There'll be great darkness upon this land when, the space between the testaments occurs. There'll be great darkness upon this land before Jesus arrives. Jesus will arrive. He'll be the great light. He'll be the light bringing, a shining light into the land of the shadow of death. Then there'll be more darkness after he leaves. Then there'll be a whole bunch of darkness before there's an Israel again. Then there'll be an Israel again. There'll be continuing darkness. Eventually he'll come back as a shining light king in the clouds, right? The return of Jesus the second time. So it literally applies to all those different things. But my favorite part of this opening passage is how he talks about Jesus in the past tense. So let's see what the next section says, so if it can shed more light upon the situation. You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For you have broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, as in the day of Midian. I don't know if y'all are ready for all this, man, because this is all crazy. Because Midian is a future kingdom. He's talking about in the past. And it's just crazy. It's crazy. So the Media Persians are going to be the final kingdom that's going to send the Jews back. They don't even exist yet. I mean, they do technically, obviously. The people exist. The place exists. But So you've multiplied the nation and increased its joy. Weren't we just in darkness? What is going on, right? So who's the you? And the you is going to be the light shining in the darkness. It's going to be God. It's going to be Jesus, right? Increasing its joy, and they're rejoicing before you like the joys of the harvest. You have broken the yoke of his burden. Whose burden? You understand what I'm saying? Like, the heck is Isaiah talking? But there is zero chance that anybody who listened to him say this would understand what he was talking about. Like, zero. Like, we have the benefit of Bible, of study Bibles, and 2,700 years, and it's virtually impossible for us to just read it and figure it out. But he's talking about God, and he's also talking about Jesus, and broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor. So the his is Israel. The burden is being oppressed. So their oppression has been broken. So they're not in oppression yet. You see what's going on? They haven't been captured by Assyrians yet. They haven't been captured by Babylonians yet. They haven't been in Babylonian captivity yet. They haven't been released by Cyrus, the king of Persia, who doesn't even exist. His whole kingdom doesn't even exist yet. None of that has happened, and this is talking about it in the past tense, how God broke the yoke of their burden, the rod of their oppressor. And it says, as in the day of Midian. Now, this could mean a bunch of different things, but as in the day of Midian could refer to Gideon's victory over the Midians, okay? So Gideon has a victory in Judges 7. It could also refer to the future victory over the Midians in the past tense of the future. I know it's crazy, okay? But basically, this is like talking about victory and whether it's the time of Judges or the future. This is verse 5. For every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle and garments rolled in blood will be used for burning and fuel of fire. Now, obviously, that's hard. It's poetry. It's prophetic. It's probably talking about the future in the past tense. You know, it's like me saying, so when we had that dinner with Jesus, I thought all the food was just amazing. It was pretty much infinite stuff. You know, wine and everything. It was really, you think it was awesome? Like, I'm talking about the future in the past tense. But there also is this connectivity of things that have happened to them in the past, right? So we got to try to figure out, what does it mean for every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle? So these are the battle sandals and garments rolled in blood. This is your clothing, your armor covered in blood. Will be used for burning and fuel for fire. So what do y'all think that means poetically? Why would you burn your battle sandals, your battle garments? Why would you burn it? You don't need them anymore, right? So the battle's over. So he's talking about the end of battle. Now we're talking about the end of the world, because the only time we're ever going to have the end of battle and the end of strife is the end of the world. When Jesus returns a second time, and we have, now of course this applies to when they're set free from their captivity, it applies to when they have victories coming in the future. There's all kinds of things this can apply to, but if you say that someone's, you know, yoke of their burden has been broken, that the rod of their oppressor has been broken, that it was like the day of Midian where they had a great victory, and then they're burning their battle gear. So I think this refers to the current time of him, which is why you know, they're not going to have to go through this battle because the first time, so don't forget the historical references. The first battle is where the Northern Kingdom teams up with Syria to try to attack them because they wouldn't go with them to fight the Assyrians. So the Northern Kingdom asked the Southern Kingdom to join the three of them to go fight the Assyrians. Southern Kingdom is like, don't think so, for lots of good reasons. First of all, God didn't say so. Second of all, they're really successful and happy, which is not necessarily a good thing. And third of all, they don't trust those guys, which is a good thing. And also, they would be destroyed. The Assyrians are no joke. They're going to mount up an attack against them, but before they can, they're going to fight the Assyrians. They're going to lose. They're all going to be destroyed. Then the Assyrians are going to come back and keep going into Jerusalem, but that's when the angels are going to kill 185,000 of them. That's not going to work out too well for the Assyrians. Then the Assyrians are going to go home. Then the Babylonians are going to come later, and they're going to actually take over, and they're actually going to take them away in chains, and that's when you have Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and all that stuff going on over there in Babylon when they're in captivity. And then the Babylonians are going to fall to the Persians, and the Persian king's going to say, why are all these Jews here? This is literally what happened. Why aren't they in their homeland sending me money? Everybody get out of here. He's going to release them all from captivity so they can go home and rebuild the temple and rebuild the kingdom of Israel, you know, both pieces, so they can have the wealth and power that Solomon and David used to have so that they can send him some of it. He's not stupid. He's like, I don't need more servants. I need all you guys to get back home and make money and send me checks. So all that stuff's about to happen, and all that stuff's about to be over long before the Romans. We got the Greeks between that and the Romans, and then we got the Romans, and then we got Jesus. It is 700, 800 years from now for Jesus. For us, that's really far in the past. For him, that's really far. And then it's at least 2,000 and, you know, whatever, hopefully not many more years till Jesus returns again. So this is referring to all that. But if your yoke is broken, if your rod of your oppressor is broken, this refers to both the imprisonment and torture of these people in the near future and the ultimate future of all God's people, which is to have their yoke lightened by Jesus. Remember, his yoke is light. To have their oppression broken, their chains broken, their freedom established by Jesus, and eventually to have that be permanent, to burn your battle gear because you don't ever have to fight again. The suffering, the pain, the tears are all over forever. How is this going to happen? And this is like one of the most famous parts of the Bible. We are in Isaiah 9:6. How is that going to happen? For unto us a child is born. I mean, come on. And this is, of course, like I said, 700 years before Jesus, but this is Jesus. I don't know if he's seeing it with his eyes. I don't know if God's telling it to him. I don't know how Isaiah is getting this message. But for unto us a child is born, for unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulder, okay? That is the rulership of everything. That is the governing of everything. And his name shall be called. Now, this is in so many church sermons from all of our lives. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, sometimes there's a comma between wonderful and counselor. Depends on your way of looking at it. He is wonderful and counselor and wonderful counselor. So sometimes people think that wonderful and counselor are one description. Mighty God is, you know, an amazing description. Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, theologically speaking, analytically and theologically speaking, that's also talking about the Trinity. If you were describing the Trinity, you would describe what? You would have a Father, right? And that would be Everlasting Father. That would be a King, And a king has a son, and the son is a prince. So that's the Prince of Peace. And what does the Holy Spirit do for us? It guides us. It's a wonderful counselor. He's a wonderful counselor. So Mighty God is a Holy Spirit, wonderful counselor, an everlasting Father, and a Prince of Peace. So that description is the overarching description of Mighty God, and a description of each of the three parts of the Trinity in that one description. So that's why people love that description of God, because it covers all the bases. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of His government and peace, there will be no end. So when He establishes the end of the battle, and everyone burns their garments covered in blood and their battle sandals, and bangs their plows, to take from another part of the Bible, bangs their swords into plows and all that stuff. There is no end. So the increase of His government and peace will see no end. Upon the throne of David and over His kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice, from that time forward, forever. From that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Now, when we're looking at the poetry and we're looking at the prophetic words and all these things, we're talking about the end of battle and conflict. We're talking about the establishment of a kingdom from the throne of David, to which there is no end forever. That has to be either a spiritual description of what happens after Jesus is on the cross, so the last 2,000 years is covered in that, or the future after He comes again. It works for both. Spiritually, bless you, spiritually the battle is over, right? Spiritually, so when it comes to spiritual battles, and when it comes to being lost in the darkness, our sandals and our blood-soaked clothes were burned on that cross 2,000 years ago. So spiritually speaking, His government has no end, and it's been always and forever. So this could be more, not metaphorical, but more symbolic language, in that it's always been, and of His increase of His government and peace, there will be no end. But specifically, speaking of the throne of David and over His kingdom, and of course you could talk about Him ruling over His kingdom in a spiritual sense, but Jesus has not yet ruled over His kingdom. When it comes to an earthly actual kingship, we haven't seen that yet. Now, we have that in our hearts. We have that in our spiritual reality, but we don't have that in the world yet. So if this speaks of His government and peace on the world being endless, that is revelation, right? That's the end. So unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. I think that the reason that echoes is because it's both. It's both Advents. The first Advent, a child is born. Nice. A son is given, and then a son is given as in given up on the cross. But also, the government will be on His shoulders. So there's no government. If you read the word government as a earthly construct of governing, that has not been on His official shoulders yet. It will be at the time of Revelation. So it really depends on how you want to read that. But obviously the first section of chapter 9 is the government of Jesus is the freedom of the light coming in the world. And he's talking about this all, you know, and I understand the confusion when a Jewish scholar, when a rabbi reads that, they're like, yeah, that's the Messiah. He's coming. When he comes, this is what's going to happen. And that's cool. That's what makes the Jewish scholars so interesting to me, because they're right. They missed the first time around, but they're right. When the Messiah comes, he will come on the clouds as a great, glorious king. He will fix everything and solve all the problems of the world. Amen, brother. They just missed the first time when he was a kid and got nailed to a cross, right? But I don't know how it's going to look. I know that the Jews are the chosen people of God. He's not going to leave them behind. I don't know how he's going to work that out. I'm not God. He's got a plan for that. But I have a feeling that, you know, I just want to be standing there, right? I don't know what's going to happen, right? But I'd like to be standing there with, like, you know, like one of my rabbi friends. And, like, Jesus is coming back. And I'm like, that's Jesus. And he's like, the Messiah's coming. And I'm like, yeah, again. Like, no. And I'm like, yeah, it's again. He's like, come on, man. I don't know. It's the same thing. We've all seen the same thing. But you just got it, you know, you didn't have that 2,000 years taken care of in between. But I don't know. I don't know what this is going to look like. But it's going to, you know, there's going to be a whole lot of Jews going, oh, Jesus. I thought you meant Jesus. That was like a different thing. I was confused. I don't know. I don't know what that's going to look like. But I have a feeling it's going to be a great day for a whole lot of people who are going to go, oh, Jesus. Got it. So this all seems like really far future. It's also referring to what's about to happen to them. They're about to get jacked, right? But it's interesting because that's definitely the far-flung future that we're talking about. Now, the next section. Now, this is like I said, he likes to give you some little, you know, some candy and a whooping. Okay. So the Lord sent a word against Jacob. The Lord sent a word against Jacob. And it has fallen on Israel. All the people will know. Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say in pride and arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with hewn stones. The sycamores are cut down, but we will replace them with cedars. Therefore the Lord shall set up the adversaries of Rezin against him and spur his enemies on, the Syrians before and the Philistines behind, and they shall devour Israel with an open mouth. Now, this is immediate future, because all that stuff about Rezin and the Syrians and the Philistines, all that stuff is talking about the non-Judah, non-Jerusalem people. It's talking about the north, and you know that the north above Israel right now is Lebanon. You know, you may or may not know that Lebanon is really, really famous for cedar. So the reference to cedars is a northern reference. And the reference to bricks falling down and hewn stones is a reference to the ways different kingdoms built things. So you're saying the stuff of the south, remember when they were making bricks and then the Pharaoh told the Israelites they couldn't have hay for the bricks, right? So bricks and the making of bricks is a southern / Egyptian type thing, right? Related to how that's done. But the hewn stones are more like how you would build things, let's say, in Assyria or Babylon. So there's a reference here to the stuff that you had is fallen down. You're just going to replace it by this stuff from these other kingdoms, by this other stuff from the north. And that's what you think. You think that it's going to be cool to be Israel, which is referring to Israel, the people, as well as the kingdom of Israel in the north, to be Israel, to be Jacob's people, and then to say with your pride and arrogance, oh, we're going to rebuild like these other guys would rebuild. We're going to be related to these other kingdoms. Saying that is basically saying we don't need God. We don't need Jerusalem. We don't need all this stuff. We just have this power and these kingdoms that are our friends and these big, giant, beautiful cedars, and we're great. And that's because the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Syria combining together. The adversaries of Rezin, so that's kingdom, that's Syria, right? Are going to be set up to come against him, and the Philistines are going to come from a different direction. They're always up to no good, the Philistines. The Syrians before, the Philistines behind, and they're going to devour Israel with an open mouth. So they're going to just suck up and destroy all of Israel. For all of this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. So this is separated. A lot of the passages, they separate that little section right there. They kind of set it apart. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. And this is the imagery of God going, hey, I got you guys. And he's reaching down and like you're getting ready to be washed away by the tide or in the pit or whatever. He's like, hey, I got you. And his hand is outstretched. All you got to do is grab his hand and he'll pull you out. But they're not. They're like, I got this. It's like, it's quicksand. Like, I got it. That's on fire. I'm good. That's underwater. No, I'm good. Okay? For the people do not turn to him. See? For the people do not turn to him who strikes them, nor do they seek the Lord of hosts. Therefore, the Lord will cut off head and tail from Israel, palm branch and bulrush in one day. The elder and the honorable, he is the head. The prophet who teaches lies, he is the tail. For the leaders of this people cause them to err. For those who are led by them are destroyed. Therefore, the Lord will have no joy in their young men, nor have mercy on their fatherless and widows. For everyone is a hypocrite and an evildoer, and every mouth speaks folly. And then it repeats, look, for all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. First of all, this is really good poetry. The way it's written is very literally strong, like literarily strong. But he's explaining exactly what's going to happen. Here's the crazy part. This hasn't happened yet. He's delivering this message, and in the message he says repeatedly, but his hand is stretched out still. All they would have to do is reach out and grab God's hand, and this will all be fixed. But they won't. So now in 18, for wickedness burns as the fire. It shall devour the briars and thorns and kindle in the thickets of the forest. They shall mount up like rising smoke. Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land is burned up, and the people shall be as fuel for the fire. No man shall spare his brother, and he shall snatch on the right hand and be hungry. He shall devour on the left hand and not be satisfied. Every man shall eat the flesh of his own arm. Now that's not necessarily literal, right? That's referring to the body of the people. Manasseh shall devour Ephraim, and Ephraim and Manasseh together, they shall be against Judah. It's talking about the kingdoms in the midst of this, all this destruction, even the kingdoms are going to fight against each other that are internal, because it's all about to end. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is outstretched still. So he says it three times. Three times he explained what's about to happen to the north. Three times he says his hand is outstretched still. And this chapter 9 is ended with his hand is outstretched still. The funniest thing when it comes to light analysis of the Bible is when people that don't really study the Bible much or know much about the Bible think God is really judgy. And like, it's the absolute opposite of that. He's like unbelievably unjudgy and merciful. Like the amount of chances he gives people, it's like over and over and over again. And we've been studying Revelation now for 7 or 8 years, right, on Sundays. And I'm just kidding. But for a long time, we've been studying Revelation on Sundays for a long time. And it is over and over and over again that everybody gets a break. And Israel gets breaks over and over. And this is them before it ever happens. Three times the prophet of God says, but his hand is stretched out still. All you have to do is reach out and grab his hand, and all this is going to be all right. But they won't. And that's the story of what's going to happen in Samaria, or in the north area of Israel, right? In the next chapter, he's going to talk about what's going to happen to Assyria. This is before Assyria's even got here. He's going to talk about what's going to happen to them later. But Assyria is going to be the tool of all the current destruction being mentioned in chapter 9. So he gives you what's going to happen in the future from the around the sea, beyond the Jordan, in Galilee, a land of Gentiles at this time. When he's writing, can you believe that? Right? The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. And that's, you don't get any more specific than that when you're just describing Jesus. And then the nation will multiply, and then there's going to be increasing joy, and it's beautiful, and there's not going to be any more battle. That's what's coming, because a child is going to be born, a wonderful counselor, a mighty God. It's going to be amazing. There's going to be no end of his kingdom. But before that, this is what's about to happen. Because you guys don't understand. I mean, think about it philosophically. We've all had like a discussion / argument with somebody. And you know how people hear arguments a different way. Like sometimes you can just say, just don't do that. And somebody just won't do it. But sometimes they'll keep doing it. And you're like, okay. And you have to explain to some people. And then some people, the explanation's good. But other people, you have to explain the consequences or what you're getting into. Like, there's different ways of talking to people. Well, he's given them two ways here. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Mars and Venus. That explains a lot.
Yeah. Well, in this place, he's explaining it to them in a couple of different ways. Hey, here's the good news about Jesus. And here's the Messiah information. Maybe that'll get you to come back on the right side and focus your attention. Because there's going to be a time when there's not going to be any more battle, and it's going to be this beautiful kingdom of peace forever. And, you know, maybe that distant vision will help some people get their life right. For other people, if you don't get your life right, you're about to be burned up. And there's the threats of what's going to happen to them. And he gives it to them in several different ways. He gives it to them in the idea of accepting things from other kingdoms. Then he gives it to them in the idea of a head and a tail being cut off and how everybody is going to be destroyed. And then he gives it to them in the idea of fire. Now they're going to be fuel for a fire. So he gives them three different ways of understanding their destruction. after giving them a positive way out, and then every single time he says his hand is stretched out still, right? God's hand is stretched out still. So he has given them all these ways of understanding what is happening. All these different approaches or metaphors or ideas about hungry, being hungry and starving, or about being burned up, or about actual enemy armies attacking, or whatever. And God does this over and over and over again. He just giving people chances after chances. The thing, like in Revelation, it's over and over and over again. And the final cups of the final wrath of God in Revelation do not get poured out to an angel, or several of them, but an angel personally explains the gospel to every single person left. So an angel flies overhead and tells this people the gospel. They hear it clearly, they see it clearly. And the people left are the ones that say, nah. I mean, not only have you seen all of the tribulation, so it's only a few years long. So you saw everybody disappear. You saw giant armies in the heavens. You saw all the torture and the locusts of the women's hair and all that stuff. You saw all the things like that happened, all the bad stuff. Then you saw the harvest of all the people that were saved and denied the beast. Then you saw all of that stuff. And now you've seen an angel go flying over and explaining personally to you the gospel. And you're still like, I'm going to take a pass. You know, this God thing is not for me. And at that point, there's literally no one left that doesn't deserve the final wrath of God. So reading that as in, oh God, man, he dumps all these plagues out on the earth and stuff. It's horrifying. The rivers turn to blood and blah, blah, blah. No, that's not it. There was years of chances. There was direct counseling intercession with every single human being. And the only people left are the ones that were like, I just can't do it, man. I just can't. I mean, they can't not believe. So think about that. Right now we have a world that has a percentage, I don't know, 5, 10, whatever percentage is, of unbelievers, people that don't believe because they don't see angels, they don't see God, they don't see it. They don't, I mean, their lives are horrible, so they don't feel it, you know, or their lives are great and they don't feel it, whatever. But they don't believe because it's a belief system. It's a faith concept. Because Jesus is not standing in front of us typically. Sometimes he does, which is awesome. But he's not usually standing in front of us saying, I am real, like he was to all the people when he was here, right? So we have to believe. And so there's unbelievers. But they can't be not believers at the end of Revelation. Because you just saw all that. You don't have any choice but to believe. The river is blood and there's an angel explaining it to you. You can't not believe unless you're just a complete moron. You'd have to be like incapable of rational thought. And I don't think they're actually like special people that can't think rational. God wouldn't just torture all the people that are, you know, special needs. That doesn't make any sense. So why are they not believing? It's because they literally are making the decision. Yes, I know there's a God. Yes, I know that there's angels. I just saw them. Yes, I know that all the people that are not here are in heaven, but I'm going to pass. How crazy is that? There has to be a core reason. It's got to be either deception or arrogance or pride or whatever. Like, I'm too prideful to bow down to anyone but myself. So therefore, I refuse to bow down, even though I know that there's a king of the universe. I refuse to bow down because I'm cooler than that. Is that the deal? I mean, it's going to be some of that. I mean, that just blows my mind. Because even a rational, logical person who was an atheist is going to be like, that was an angel. Okay, I'm in. Like, if you're like, oh man, you're an atheist when it was a belief system, you had your website, and it was all good, and you were working at Yale on physics or whatever. But now it's like, okay, there's rivers of blood and demons flying around, and there's angels in the sky telling me stuff. So, okay, I guess I was wrong, and it's not just worm food, and I'm going to take a closer look at this. I'm in. I mean, how would you not be? You would have to be so overwhelmed with your own, like, self-worth that you don't think it's worth it. I mean, I don't. Anyway, those are the people that take the last hit, and they take the big hit. They take the no more sky hit, you know. So anyway, that is all hinted at in this, as well as the immediate future of the Assyrian attack. It's all happening at the same time. I don't know if Isaiah was completely nuts, but I would imagine that he was crazy. Like, if you, I would imagine that if you sat down and tried to talk to Isaiah, you couldn't. Like, he'd be like, because there's so much, because he's seeing so many things. And this is 66 book chapters in this book, okay? And I'm sure he didn't have a chance to write every single minute down either. There's going to be a whole section where he's just going to be naked for a while. It's coming up. He's just going to be buck naked for a while. I'm pretty sure he's nuts, but in a good way. What I mean by that is that he's seeing so much stuff. He's seeing like Jesus in past tense. I mean, how do you get your head around? Because we know it's a minimum of 2,700 years, maybe more, right? How do you get your head around some type of view or understanding of like 2,700 years, of like the first coming of Jesus and the second coming, the end of all time, just crazy enough to get your head around, but also Jesus coming in the first place, but also the battles that are just about to happen. This army is actually coming now. They'll be here within months or years. This is all happening. Then there's another army behind that. Then there's another army behind that. Then they get imprisoned. Then they get released. He's seeing all of that. And I don't know if he can understand it, but if he can't fully understand it and God is orchestrating the words because he can't really get it, and God's giving him the words to say and what to do, if that's how it works, then he's a nut burger. Because he can't even understand what he's talking about. He knows that something crazy is going to happen, and a child is going to be born, and it's going to be in the Galilee area. And is he seeing it? Is he seeing Jesus like walk across water? And it's like, wow, that is awesome. I mean, I don't know. We don't have any way of knowing. We know that his writing is extremely good when it comes to a literary, like editorial perspective. His writing is extremely good. So we know that he's a naturally gifted poet, prophet, writer, speaker, etc. And God is using all of that, just like he used Moses, just like he used David. He's using all of that to explain all of this. And he's explaining it to the people at the time, but also the next generation, and also five generations later, and also the time of Jesus. And like I said, this book is, besides things like Proverbs, the most quoted thing in the New Testament. All of the disciples, Jesus himself, are pulling out Isaiah all the time. It doesn't get any bigger than Isaiah when it comes to the Bible in general. It doesn't when it comes to the meanings and the depth of something. Because he's covering everything. He might as well cover Genesis to Revelation in like summary, but it's like summary that's so poetic it's hard to get your head around. But every single time that he's talking about this big giant disaster befallen people, but his hand is stretched out still. All you have to do is realize the Messiah is coming. All you have to do is reach out and take God's hand, and all of this will be over. If no one else does, you'll be the remnant. You will survive. You will not be tortured. Just like at the end of time, when you know the rapture happens and we avoid the tribulation, right? That's possible right now. It's possible all the time. It's possible in our lives, your life right now, without Jesus. Go back to when that changed and go, okay, if I went the other fork in that road, what does your life look like? And maybe that's too long to remember. Maybe that's recent. But that's going to be a horrible story. It's what it's going to be. I don't know. I can't even count how many times I should be dead. I mean, if I go back and really look at it. Like, I can't even count it. Not to mention, I just told the falling off the cliff story. That's just one of a thousand times that God said, not today. And I was like, but I'm really dumb, and I'm really trying to kill myself all the time. And he's like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you. You've got stuff to do. In 25 years, there'll be this weird Bible class you'll be doing about Isaiah. It'll be awesome. But I'm like, really? I'm living on Bourbon Street above a strip club right now. Are you sure? You know, that's what happened. I'm a cook. I didn't know any better. I'm 20-something. I don't know how much you guys knew when you were 20-something. I did not know anything except, you know, where the next, you know, party was. That's all I knew when I was 20-something. So he knew that back then, you know, because I did so much really, really dumb stuff that should have killed me over and over. I just wasn't thinking straight. Or accidents happen, or I try to, like, save some girl that's getting beat up in the street, and then I'm beating her boyfriend up, and then she pulls a gun on me because that's her man. I mean, that happened in the streets of New Orleans. And I'm like, are you really pulling a gun on me right now? Because he was just beating you a minute ago. And then she's like, get away from my man. I'm like, hey, look, I'm out of here, you guys. You guys do you, because this is not making sense to me. And I mean, that kind of stuff happened all the time in New Orleans. I was robbed 5 times, man. I mean, New Orleans is nuts. Living in there, in the French Quarter for my whole 20s. I mean, I don't even know how many times I should be dead. And God's like, no, not today. Fall off a cliff. That's not today, you know. And if you, I mean, without God, I mean, I don't know. I probably wouldn't have made it. I mean, I was probably basically born dead in a way. Probably wouldn't have made it out of birth to start with. My mom didn't see me for days. They swished me away to the ICU and stuff. I probably wasn't even supposed to be alive ever, like ever. But God was like, yeah, you're going to live, you know. I mean, I just think about what happens when that doesn't exist. Like, what happens when you divorce yourself from that? And, you know, and then you think about all these people running around right now with that same situation where their life is really crappy, and you tell them, if you turn to God and ask for help, you will get it. It's actually the way it works. It's real. And they're like, nah, my heroin is just awesome. And I'm like, I'm sure it is. I'm sure heroin is just, it rocks. I'm sure a lot of great rock stars have loved it. But they're dead, most of them. But whatever, you know. I mean, I get it. But still, his hand is stretched out. And this is eternal. This passage. That's why Isaiah is such a big deal eternally. It's a big deal from the day he wrote it down to today. I don't think there'll be anybody pulling out scripture when the world ends, because it'll be the world ending and there won't be any need for any of that anymore. But if they pulled out scripture at the end, it's going to be Isaiah. It'll be Isaiah and Revelation that they're reading from during the tribulation. When the groups of Christians get together, because all those other guys disappeared, and they're like, let's take a look. I'm pretty sure this is happening right now. Let's take a look. And they're like, that's exactly what just happened. Yeah, I think this is true. How do you pray? Like, I don't know. I think we close our eyes and put our hands together. Let's figure this out. Oh, hold on, flip back a couple pages. Jesus tells you how to pray. Okay, all right, let's pray. And that'll be happening. That's not me making something up. That's exactly what's going to be happening in the tribulation, because there's going to be enough smart people that they're going to look around and go, oh, crap, this is what Revelation said. And they're like, oh, let's Does anybody have a Bible? Quick, go to the hotel. Okay. There's one in the drawer. There's a Motel 6. Okay, what does it say? Anyway, I mean, that's literally going to be happening. What would you do if you're riding on a bus and, like, half the bus disappeared and it crashed and you lived and walked out of the bus like, is this? No. Maybe? Let me go look at this Bible thing for a minute, because I think this might be in there. I don't know. That's why we're all in heaven praying, because all that stuff's going on down here, because we disappear. And then it's like prayer time. There's a whole giant prayer meeting in heaven in Revelation right after that, because all the people that go to heaven go, oh no, all those people are left. And we know exactly what's coming their way right now. And we all start praying because we've got relatives left, right? We got people, and maybe it's a spouse, and maybe it's a great-grandkid. It depends on the timing, right? You know, it could be, you know, anybody. It could be, you know, any time frame. We don't know. But we do know that we're going to know people or be related to people and go, oh, no. No, no, no. We got to get Johnny out of the tribulation, man. He's not a bad kid. He just won't listen when I talk about the Bible. But he's not a bad kid. Well, he's figuring it out right now. Johnny is sitting in the cafeteria figuring it out right now. Well, this is what this is about. His anger is not going to be turned away. In other words, he's the people that crap on everybody else and, you know, abuse people and do so in full knowledge of what they're doing, they're not going to get away with it. The people that mock God and think it's all stupid and they're not going to get away with it. His anger is not going to be turned away. But his hand is stretched out still. That's the best way to understand the wrath of God. Because that's hard. Because we think of God as loving. God is love. So how does it work that God is love, period? There is no darkness in him, period. But there is wrath. And that's very difficult, especially for borderline Christians, universalist Christians. It's very hard to figure out what that means. It's a very difficult, and of course, everyone else. It's very hard to figure out what that's about. But it's very similar to parenting. Because you have to do something to stop them from destroying themselves. If you can, figure it out. But it's very similar to like the parent of, you know, a bad person who's a thief or a killer or whatever. And you are hard parenting now, not bailing them out, doing everything that you can to try to get them to understand. But your hand is stretched out still. If they will just grab your hand and follow what you're trying to say and stop the shenanigans, it'll be okay. And they have to make that decision to reach out and grab your hand and say, I am so sorry, I am going to change my ways, and they have to mean it. This is exactly the same thing. I mean, it's our little mini version, but God has his hand outstretched. All you got to do is repent and not turn back to that thing and grab hold of his hand, and you'll be pulled out of the muck. It's just that simple. But people are like smacking their hands, you know, your kid. I don't know if you've ever had like a kid that was in full-on rebellion mode where you're like, I just want to help you. Like, yeah, hey, I hate you. You know, and that's humans. God's like, here's my hand. Like, I got to do what I'm going to do it my way. And God's like, just like a parent. God's like, okay, I mean, good luck with that. I mean, I know what's going to happen, so good luck, you know. But I'm right here. You can come stay in my house. All you got to do is go to church, you know, and you know, not sell drugs. It'll be okay. His hand is stretched out still.
It's interesting, though. I think it's the Sistine Chapel that has the painting of God reaching out his hand, Adam. And if you look at that closely, you'll see that God's hand is fully stretched out and his finger is fully stretched out. They're doing the whole ET thing. But Adam's finger is And if he would just finish that stretch out, then the touch would be there. But yeah, just brought that to mind where God's fully reaching out his hand to us, but we're kind of not quite there.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. It is. It's God's got his thing out. God's like stretched out. Adam's got sort of a limp lip, like a limp wrist, lip finger. Like he's like, yeah. And it is. It's so close. This is obviously a whole different thing. Michelangelo, of course, is a genius, and you have to really get your head around it because it's so amazing. And also, the figures, God is coming down from heaven and reaching out, and Adam is laying back, like chilling. He's got the, like, reposed, laid-back position. He's like, you know. And that is such a commentary, right? Also, you know, Adam is basically by himself, right? He's laying on this little hill thing on earth, you know, by himself. God is surrounded by, so God's coming with a whole host. He's coming with a whole army of awesomeness. He's coming down, he's reaching out. He's in full-on, like, flying Superman mode. And Adam's like, I mean, you're exactly right. That's a huge deal. He liked to make these incredible images that were eternal, like David. So the statue of David, so he makes David. And the statue of David, if you see a picture of it, you don't get it because the picture is of a guy holding a sling and it's David. You're like, cool. Renaissance David. But that's not the point. The only way to understand the point is to go there. Because when you walk in the room with David, you go like this. Because David is massive. David's like 20 feet tall or whatever. And you're like, oh. Because the point is David is the giant. So David is a little guy that fights a giant that beats a giant. But in reality of the universe, David is the giant. And the giant is nothing. And you're standing there staring at it like for hours. Like, I'm trying to get your head around it. It's same thing. Sistine Chapel, same thing. It's like his imagery. And a lot of those guys, a lot of those Renaissance creators were really channeling God, like hard channeling God, because God is the great creator, so the creative arts in us are a reflection of him. Part of the way we're made in God's image is our creativity, and so one of the greatest painters or sculptors of all time would have to be imbued with a whole lot of who God is, because God is creativity. He's a creator. And Michelangelo is a little mini creator, right? And he's creating these things. And so he's got to be full of God, basically. And so what he's doing, whether it's on purpose or not, what he's doing is these massive universal representations. That kind of art blows my mind. Like, I've always been a big art fan, like a major art fan. And historical art like that, sometimes you get a piece and you just stare at it like, what is really going on? Like, think about the Mona Lisa for a second. It's just a how many pictures or paintings of a person are there? Like billions, like millions upon millions. How many really famous, really powerful painters painted a portrait of somebody? Like millions. Why is this one little weird painting of this one little, why is it a big deal? It doesn't make any sense because there's literally millions of paintings like that. So what is it? And you have to stand there and stare at it and figure it out. And it's not going to happen quick. You know, stand there until the guard yells at you because they're trying to close. And you're like, I don't know what you're saying. I'm American and I'm from the South and you're speaking French. And he's like, I'm telling you in English to leave. I'm like, yeah, but your it's really strong accent. I don't know what you're saying. You just answered me. You know what I'm saying? No, I don't really. I need to stand here for another couple of minutes. Like, I'm going to go that room and then I'm going to come back and you better leave. You know, and you're staring at it like, what is going on right now? That's what great art is. That's what great art is. Like, it's mind-boggling. But great art, for the most part, is infused with God, even if the person doesn't know it. Because art is a creator. So if you're going to create a piece of art, so God knows all of history, right? So if you're going to create a piece of art, and that piece of art is going to be eternal, you know, in a way, right? So like Mona Lisa or, you know, Sistine Chapel. God knows that, and God is the great creator, and you're basically channeling God to do that. So God's going to put a message through, even if you don't have any idea what's going on. And so you stand there, you look at that Monet painting or whatever, and you're just like, what is this about? And sometimes it's just capturing a natural scene, but you start to realize that that's a bigger deal than that. Like the timing of everything, like the way that nature works, the way God works. I mean, it's just this huge deal. And so the way that Isaiah's writing is actually at that same level as Michelangelo's painting. Literarily speaking, it's very intensive, extremely well-written poetry. Just like great poetry that we recognize as poetry. But the addition to that, just like the Sistine Chapel, the addition to that is that God has put into it great deep messages, such as my hand is always extended, right? And that, you know, how many times has that imagery been explained or suggested, you know, from right now in Isaiah to the Sistine Chapel, that whole concept. And then you think about that, and this will be the last thing for tonight, but then you have to get your head around why. Why would God reach out? So God is the God of the universe. He doesn't need us. He doesn't need the planet. He doesn't need the universe. He doesn't need anything. He's an immortal, eternal, all-powerful being. Has no need of anything. Nothing you can do. No amount of Bitcoin is going to satisfy him. Okay, it doesn't matter. Okay, it doesn't matter if you sacrifice your kid or you don't. It doesn't matter. He doesn't need you to do anything stupid or weird. Okay? He doesn't need anything. He could make a million planets, a billion people, every second of every day, and it doesn't matter. So why would he reach out to our crazy butts, right? Like, well, why? And that's the deal. That is the actual whole deal. Trying to get your head around that, that's the whole story. Because that explains every single person in the Bible, every single word in the Bible, every single religious leader that ever lived, on the good side and the bad side. It explains every single thing that ever happened since the dawn of the universe is the answer to that question, which we do not have, because that is the great mystery. Why? God is, so you ask God who he is, and he'll say, as they did, he says, I am. What does that even mean? We can't get our head around that. It's like two little tiny words. It's a one-letter word and a two-letter word. You can't get a shorter sentence. You can't get smaller words. I think that's kind of funny. It's like, I'm going to make this as simple as actually possible. I am. And you're like, I don't get it. I am. I mean, we still don't get it. I mean, we got theories about I am. I am in God is, and therefore everything is, and that's it. That's the universe. That's everything. That's all of us. That's all of the universe. That's all the atoms. I am. Okay. It also gets echoed in a really timely fashion when Jesus, who is God on earth, is asked if he is God or he is the Messiah or whatever he is, and he says, I am. Right? So you get, I am. And we can't even get our head around that. But it's the mystery of the universe. And if you have an answer, email me, okay? Because why? Why would God bother to know who Sharon is and everything about Sharon and order her day and protect her from all kinds of crazy every day? Why? Or me or my kids or whatever. Why? And he does. He knows the hair on your head or the lack thereof, okay? He knows the number of hairs. He knows the number of ants, the number of grains of sand. He knows where you, if you step your foot on the beach, he knows how many pieces of sand you just touched. He's infinite in all ways. Why does something infinite in all ways give a crap about my completely finite, worthless butt? And that's it. That's the great mystery of the universe. Now, we have some pretty good theological answers from the Bible, things like companionship when it comes to the idea of community. God is a Trinity. Therefore, God is community innately and a creator innately. Therefore, create something to be in community with. That's a pretty dry theological understanding of why we exist, but it's pretty good. And he tried it a couple times, evidently. He did it with angels, too. We don't know what else is out there. You know, there's probably, you know, people on Alpha Centauri worshiping Glubnok, who came and saved them, right? And that was his god coming down to, you know, Alpha Centauri 4 as Glubnok. I don't know. You know, I always wanted to write a science fiction book where the two guys that were like the astronauts, you know, they came together from the two different races and they met in space and it was the first contact and they began talking and they had this whole thing where the captain of the two crews were talking and they had this translator, right? The computer translator who enabled them to talk. And in the middle of the conversation, they're trying to evangelize each other, talking about God and Jesus, but they're both doing it. And then they realize through the course of the book that every people and every planet God came to save everyone. And our story is here on Earth. And he's like, wait a second. Did Glubnok get nailed to a cross? No, Glubnok got burned up in the Shaitan. It's this thing that rips you apart really slowly, pulls your atoms apart. That sounds horrible. It's the most horrible thing that existed when he was here. Like, bingo, that's your cross. What do you call that? Twisty thing? Oh, that's the necklace. That's why it's a twisty thing. Yeah, this is how they ripped him apart. Oh, yeah, that's what this is, a cross. They nailed him to it. Oh. That'd be a pretty cool book, I think. Mm-hmm. Hardcore Christian science fiction coming at you. Okay. Anyway. The point of this is that Isaiah is hitting every nook and cranny of all of time. And what is the summary? Unto us a child is born, so it's going to be okay. And no matter what you're doing and how bad it is, God's hand is still outstretched. And that's an awesome message. There's a whole lot of darkness and scary, like, yeah, the Assyrians are coming to kill you all. Okay, you're all going to burn like fuel on a fire. Yes, that's horrifying. But the primary message is amazing. God's hand is still outstretched. I'm curious why, and I think it's the same heart that's in those people at the end of Revelation that have heard the gospel but refuse. Because how would somebody hear that message from Isaiah and understand that what he's saying is true and then not reach out for God? How could somebody not do what he's saying, what God is saying? And they don't. And so, you know, it's going to be bad. Anyway, this chapter is just amazing. And this is where our "under us a child is born" passage comes from. That is really thick. Is it big letters or is it like... Gotcha. Large print, but it's also a study Bible.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool right there. That's a nice one. Which version is it?
My
cool. So it's NIV basically. Yeah, that's cool. That's a good one. That's a nice one right there. Anyway, does anybody have any questions or comments? I know that we've like We went all the way to Michelangelo tonight, so it's kind of weird. But yeah, I just, I'm in awe. Every time we go through any of these passages, it just, if you camp out for a minute, it just blows your mind. And the way he says stuff sometimes is so difficult to just read it. If you just sit there and read it, like, you go, you know, 5 minutes before you get on the bus, so you read it. It doesn't work like that. You got to camp out on it and figure out what is really going on. And it's absolutely, like, stunning what's happening. And the fact that he talks about Jesus in the past tense. Like, there was this time where there was this darkness around Galilee and the light came into it. I'm like, you mean Jesus, like, 700 years from now? Like, in the past tense? Where is he standing? Like, is he standing in his mind or in his vision? Is he standing in 1973 or 814? AD, where is he standing, or the end of time, when he sees in the past that the darkness had a light that pierced it? Or is it just a metaphorical vision? God's showing him a light pierced the darkness, and he knows that that's going to be a child coming to the earth to solve the problem. I mean, how is he getting this download? And I think about that, I think Isaiah freaked out a lot. That's just me. Personally, I think he's like, come on, and runs around a lot like that. Like, come on. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's totally calm all the time. But I think he sees stuff and God shows him stuff. And he's like, come on. That was like, what is that? Why is everybody on fire? You know, I don't know. I have no idea. I'll find out one day. And I'll be like, so, hey, Isaiah, you got a minute? He's like, yeah, are you going to ask me about being naked again? I'm so tired of that question. Anyway, we'll get to that later. All right. Thanks for playing. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, oh, man, thank you so much, Lord. Thank you for this place and this time and your word and the ability to just meet together and talk about it and dig down into it. And it's just so, so great. We're so grateful. And just full of joy. The word that you bring to us is so important and touching, and it guides us in all these different ways. Please touch our hearts and our minds and keep us moving ever closer and closer to you. Please open up your word, and not just these passages, but all the passages that we read, and open up your word to us and show us what you would have us see. We're so grateful for this church and this place to meet and everyone here and the people that couldn't make it tonight because they're having whatever thing they're having going on. So please bless everyone here mightily, Lord. Protect them as they travel around. Protect their home and their finances and their hearts and their minds. Just protect their health and their families. Keep them safe. All the people who normally here want to be here and can't, protect them. Reach out and touch them and guide all of us. Have your way in our lives and guide us closer and closer to you. We want to be the remnant in the way that we want to know you and know more of you and be guided by you and not be turned away and not be lost in the darkness. We want your light to shine in our lives. We love you with all of our hearts. We thank you for this and we beg you for more every day, more protection, more blessing, more of you in our lives. Protect everyone here until we come back together again. We pray these things in the mighty and unstoppable name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Heads up, our daughter.